currently Kirkland. Your source for city news and events in the community. With Scott Mullen at the news desk. Stay up to date with weekly news reports on what's happening in Kirkland. Now, here's Scott.
Hi, this is currently Kirkland, and I'm Scott Mullet. Yep, thank you. Through our show, every week, you can engage with your community by discovering the latest developments in citywide events. Up first, Kirkland's Totem Lake Flood Control Project passed its first two tests in November when rain hammered the city with two separate rainstorms.
I just want to say what a fabulous project. I never had any expectation that you would get such fabulous outcomes so quickly. The businesses up in Totem Lake are going to be so relieved not to be flooded out. I remember getting all that correspondence last year. So well done.
Normally, the rain that fell Thanksgiving week would have flooded Totem Lake Boulevard, forcing the city to shut down an important artery of commerce. But the efforts last August of the public works staff to remove a beaver dam and roughly 1,800 cubic yards of invasive vegetation and sediment from three areas downstream of Totem Lake reduced the area's susceptibility to flooding. That work improved the lake's natural ability to drain, and as a result, it increased its capacity to store water. Engineers measure this additional capacity in terms of freeboard, which refers to the distance between the top of the bank and the lake's surface. The flood control project increased Totem Lake's freeboard from 2 to nearly 4 feet.
What is really cool about this graph is it shows how quickly the water went away, and that went away that quickly because of the removal of the sediment and the vegetation and the beaver dams.
As an added precaution, the Public Works Department has placed a pump downstream of the lake, which can move 1.7 million gallons of water per day. The city will use this pump during rainstorms and in anticipation of significant rain events.
2 years ago, we had the Totem Lake Symposium where business owners and property owners came together to identify some of the barriers to the Totem Lake Business District. And flooding was identified, and we asked staff to take a look at it. And you have done an amazing job. And just today, I had Ellen Miller Wolf and I had lunch with a new employer who is bringing a new business to Totem Lake with over 300 employees. And the things that we asked him, what do you want from a city when you are relocating a business? And he said, you know, I want predictability. I want to know that, you know, that the rules are thus and, you know, I can predict what's going to happen. And I thought I'd tell him a little bit about some of the things we were doing in Totem Lake, and I couldn't believe how excited he was about flooding.
After months of discussion, the Denny Creek Neighborhood Alliance last week modified its bylaws, broadened its mission, and changed its name. The newly named Finn Hill Neighborhood Alliance elected 5 more members to the board that will represent the neighborhood's 15,000 residents and serve as their primary conduit to the city. The Finn Hill Neighborhood Alliance now has a broader community agenda rather than one focused entirely on Finn Hill's lush environment. Since the June 1st annexation, members of the Denny Creek Neighborhood Alliance had been considering two opposing opportunities: create a new neighborhood association or expand the existing alliance to encompass neighborhood goals and concerns. Still, protecting Finn Hill's rich environment is a top alliance priority. The alliance developed a 10-item project list for 2011 and 2012. 8 of the projects are focused on enhancing or protecting some aspect of Finn Hill's natural environment. This includes the alliance's ongoing 5-year effort to counter the root rot that is killing 40 acres of Douglas firs at Juanita Woodlands. The alliance plans to plant 10,000 new trees, one at a time. Historically, the tree planting attracts 50 to 60 volunteers, but the Alliance is always looking for more. To find out how you can volunteer, visit dennycreek.org. When Matt McCauley compiled 2 years' worth of his newspaper columns on Kirkland's early history into a book, he had no idea if anyone would be interested in it. Soon after the 2010 release of A Look to the Past, Macaulay's book has become Kirkland's most recent go-to source for local history. Readers love the large format, the decades-old photographs and vignettes. Still, some readers complained the book was incomplete due to the omission of one element that is essential to any book of record, an index. With the help of a local librarian, Macaulay used that omission to introduce a second edition, complete with an index and a new story that illuminates the crippling power of disease. We met with Matt Macaulay at Park Place Books last week to discuss this story and others he has included in his book.
When I was working on that book, it was pretty constant through the summer of 2010. For
constant.
About 3 months.
5-6 hours a day?
Oh, more than that, probably, yeah. I mean, I would go 7 days a week down to the Heritage Society, and I'd be down there for sometimes 10 hours a day. I think what mostly inspired it was people telling me after I got back, I kept all your old columns. You should put them together in a book.
So you wrote the columns when you were in your 20s?
Yeah, I was in my 20s. I was an undergraduate at Seattle University. I kind of got bit with a history interest as a young kid. We had four houses all in a row out in what was then very rural Juanita. And I used to talk to my next door neighbor, Mr. and Mrs. Fowler, about the history of Kirkland. And it fascinated me, you know, riding the ferry and all the stories of the different things that they used to tell. It was with the change that had come to Kirkland, because at that time, you had major developers like Harvey Chaussee and some of these others that were putting in a lot of housing developments and things. So the Juanita of my early childhood was very rural. It was full of, you know, livestock and pastures and wheel rut dirt roads and things like that. And in a very short period of time, it turned into the subdivisions and sort of urban environment that we know now. So I think in my case, some of what prompted my interest in history was just the ability to sort of get grounded on all this change that was occurring all around me.
If you were to look back at Kirkland to its founding, what would you say was the most influential era?
Well, probably the most influential era was Peter Kirk and his enterprise to build a steel empire here, 1888 to about 1893. That's when the streets were platted in what is now West of Market neighborhood in Norkirk. The iconic brick buildings at Market and 7th were built at that time. That was probably the most influential period, and that's where, of course, Kirkland got its name. The Peter Kirk steel enterprise wanted to get a ship canal built because they wanted to have saltwater vessels come to Kirkland, and then the steel rails they were going to build, which are railroad tracks, which was the vision. They never created a single railroad track. They never produced a single ingot of steel after having spent all kinds of money. But nonetheless, the idea was that they would, up on Rose Hill, where the Costco is now, is where they had the steel mill, and the rails would be built there and taken down by a tram to the water and placed on ships and taken out to foreign ports. And that depended on building the Lake Washington Ship Canal. So it turned into a big battle in Olympia, and there were sides pro and there were sides con. And the side that was con used to refer to the canal project as the Kirkland Ditch, as if it was a big boondoggle, that it, were it built, would just benefit Kirkland. And Kirkland's major competitor at that time was Tacoma, because Tacoma had a smelter and was involved in steel manufacturing. So you have this rivalry, and Tacoma forces didn't want Kirkland to succeed, and Kirkland forces did want Kirkland to succeed. And Kirkland had some prominent Seattle area backers, including Arthur Armstrong Denny, who was pretty much the founder of Seattle and the namesake of the Denny Party from 1851. And he was a heavy investor in Kirkland, and he was a business partner of Peter Kirk's. So you had these forces at odds down in Olympia, and as it turned out, a major national depression called the Panic of 93 occurred, and that made the whole thing moot, because it was such a financial crisis that there was no money left to build canals or anything else. Interestingly, Kirkland was not actually founded until after Peter Kirk had left and moved to the San Juan Islands in 1905. So you really have major eras. You have the Homestead era of the 1870s, you have the Kirk era of circa 1890, and then you have the actual town, the true founding, which was around 1905. And by the time this town was actually founded, most of the steel empire people had actually left, because it was just an investment to them that had failed, and they had moved on, with the exception of his secretary, Walter Williams, who had a huge estate at what is now Juanita Bay Park, which was called Glandwa, which is a Welsh word for by the sea. And he had retained that, and it stayed in his family until they sold it to the Farrars, and it became the old Juanita Bay Golf Course. But with the exception of Williams, most of the steel empire people had all drifted away by the time the town was founded in 1905. And then ultimately, the canal wasn't constructed until 1916. And Peter Kirk did live long enough to actually see the canal. It occurred just about, just it was opened shortly before his death.
You devote an entire chapter to the World Wars.
Right. Those were a very, very significant for the town of Kirkland for a couple of reasons. First of all, when World War I came around, most of the men that went into the military served together. That was prior to the days of the Sullivan brothers in the Second World War, where they intentionally mixed people up. Back in World War I, if you were from a particular geographic area, it's likely that you would all go in together. So much of the male population of Kirkland who went and fought in World War I were all in around the same unit. So when they came back, the Warren Grimm post of the American Legion was highly influential. The unit doctor was Dr. McKibben Sr., and he later became the mayor, and he was the head of the American Legion post. Most of the people that were very prominent in town had served together in the First World War. As a matter of fact, they had cannons set up at the south end of Kirkland and at the north end of Kirkland. I mean, it was a very different vibe. But then the Second World War, you had the Lake Washington Shipyards, which is now Carillon Point, and that was a really significant employer. That brought in tens of thousands of people to the Kirkland area, and they built seaplane tenders and other vessels for World War II down there, and that was an amazing shift in Kirkland's population in the Second World War.
And one of the things that contributed to that period was the Montlake Cut, is that right?
Yeah, in 1916 you connected Lake Washington with the salt water, so that really changed the ball game as far as Lake Washington shipyards went. After 1916, they were able to build saltwater vessels, which really made the shipyards become a major employer for Kirkland area.
You spend some of your time diving into Lake Washington.
Yeah, I've been diving in the lake since 1978, and I got my start in the lake because I was finding a lot of old bottles and other relics from the 1800s out there.
So what are some of the more interesting things you found down there?
Well, we recovered 5 World War II combat aircraft back in the 80s, 3 SB-2C Helldiver dive bombers and 2 Grumman F4F Wildcat fighters. There are several that we located that are still on the bottom of the lake, large Navy World War II era bombers.
You wrote this book, or compiled the book, in 2010.
Right, summer of 2010. There hasn't been a history of Kirkland of this type written since 1975, when the late Arlene Ely wrote Our Foundering Fathers. And since 1975, Kirkland has grown substantially. So Kirkland is now a much larger place, and the story is a lot broader. And the thirst for that information is also a lot more substantial, you know, over 35 years. And so after I released the book, it did enormously well, but I had a lot of people come to me and say, Matt, love the book, but you should put an index on that. I had a collaborator, Amy Muser, who came for, she's getting her master's degree in library science, and she took on the arduous task of putting together the index. And then I made some minor corrections from some things where new information had come to light. And then I added a new chapter that I wrote in 2011 on KirklandViews.com about the Clark tragedy, the Clark family tragedy that occurred in 1882, because I thought that really should go with kind of the basic history of Kirkland. So that's why I added it to the second edition.
And can you tell us what that story is all
yeah,
about?
Yeah, the Clark family were some people who in the very early 1880s came to the Seattle area and took a homestead up by what is now Green Lake. Weren't terribly happy with that homestead, so they sold their right to preempt the land and came over here in 1882 and took out a 160-acre homestead at what is now the Highlands neighborhood. And they lived alone in the woods up there, in the very thick woods. Their nearest neighbor was the DeMott family, who had the homestead at what is now downtown Kirkland. So their next door neighbor was about a mile away. They were out there by themselves. They had 3 small children, and then a baby, and a dog. And the father was a shoemaker, Martin Clark, and he would work during the week in Seattle working on shoes. And we leave his wife and kids in the house. And so, you know, they were out in the middle of the woods, and there were some sad kinds of things that occurred. For example, one night the wife, Mrs. Clark, Eliza Clark, thought that an Indian or some kind of a criminal was breaking into their house. And so she saw a movement out through the window and blasted it with a Black Power shotgun, thinking she was killing an intruder. She killed their dog, not knowing what it was. And so, I mean, this was kind of scary. I mean, these people would hear the screams of cougars at night and all kinds of things that were then a part of the fabric of the wilderness that was Kirkland. And ultimately, what ended up happening, very sadly, is that during a diphtheria epidemic, they lost, within a period of 3 days, their 3 older children. ages 9, 7, and 4, within a period of 3 days, right there in their house. And then at the end of that, the baby started seeming sick, and the wife started seeming sick. So with the help of a neighboring hunter slash trapper, a French Canadian, they borrowed a rowboat, went over to Seattle, sought help in the hospital, but were not allowed into the hospital because they were sick, which is the way things were back in those days. If you were too sick, they didn't let you into the hospital because you might get everybody sick and die, especially if it was diphtheria. So here they were, the father, the sick wife, the baby, and their friend out in the muddy streets, the muddy sawdust streets of Seattle, forlorn in the gray rain, not knowing what was going to happen, and after having just lost their three kids right in front of them. And they heard a voice behind them offering them assistance. They looked up, and it was a nun. And she said, "Can I help you?" And they said, "Well, you know," they explained that they were sick, and they just had the three kids die, and they didn't know what they were going to do. She said, "Come with me, I'll help you." And they were very devout Protestants, and they told her, they said, "I'm sorry, sister, we're not Roman Catholics." And she said, "It doesn't matter, you're children of God, come with me." So she took them and got a doctor to help them and spent about a month or 6 weeks nursing them back to health in Seattle. And then they reached a point where the father, Martin Clark, asked the wife, Eliza, if they want to leave the homestead after all the suffering and everything, should we move on? She said, "No, I'm not going to leave my children," because the children were buried up there in the Highlands neighborhood. So she lived the rest of her days with near the graves of her three little children who had died. She had two additional children after that. And ultimately, the children were exhumed and are now resting with the mother and father and their sister in the Kirkland Cemetery. But she would not leave the graves of those little kids. And they gradually sold pieces of their property and pieces of their homestead, especially because when the Kirk boom came and imploded, they lost a lot of money on that, like a lot of the homesteaders did. But what's funny is the baby, the little girl, grew up to become a very beautiful woman. There's a picture of her in the book. And she was the very first graduate of Kirkland High School. And she married a man who was drifting through town to visit his cousins. But he met her and thought she was so beautiful, he stayed and married her. And he became the very first city treasurer of Kirkland when it was incorporated in 1905, a position that he held for 45 years until his death. And so they're all buried up there in the Kirkland Cemetery together. And their grandchildren were contributors to the book, who helped me with some of the photographs. And they're still alive and well and with us in our community today.
How did you pick that story? I mean, there must have been others.
The son that was born after the death was a Dr. Charles Walter Clark, and he became a very prominent researcher in the area of venereal disease, which people tend to smirk about now, but in the old days, pre-penicillin, that was a very serious source of human suffering. And I have to speculate that after having lost his older siblings to disease, if that maybe inspired him to go into medicine and to work toward the eradication of disease. He was an award-winning, very prominent medical doctor, and he had the presence of mind to take down the information from his parents and record it in a semi-fictional form. And it was from that record that I was able to write that chapter, along with homestead file records that corroborated a lot of what he said.
One final note with a final reminder. The Washington State Department of Transportation just announced that tolling on the State Route 520 bridge begins December 29th at 5 a.m. Commuters are encouraged to be aware of the upcoming changes and have a commute plan ready. If you plan to take the bridge and would like to pay the lowest rate, you should set up your good-to-go accounts now so you'll hopefully receive a pass before tolling starts. My pass is already in hand. If you've purchased a pass, you might want to make sure it's activated. Tolling on the 520 will provide $1 billion toward the $4.65 billion for a new floating bridge, safety, and mobility improvements from I-5 in Seattle to State Route 202 in Redmond. The state hopes to open the new bridge in late 2014. Visit wasdot.wa.gov/good-to-go for pass information. Now, don't miss our special holiday episode next week. Be sure to tune in. I have a few studio audience guests with me today to remind you that previous episodes of Currently Kirkland are available on demand on the city's website, your mobile devices, and on YouTube. And wouldn't we love to hear from the folks in the audience, girls?
Yeah,
that's right. So if you have any news tips, suggestions, or comments, please send them to kirklandtv@kirklandwa.gov. I'm Scott Mullett.
And thanks for watching.